This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Werewolf. I'm your host for tonight, Dion. Hope everybody can hear me okay out there tonight. I got a whole new setup here. I got a new mic, got new headphones, I got a new everything. I figured it's about time I kind of upgrade some of my equipment here. Stop using the old Logitech piece of crap headset that I was using. I got a real mic. Hope it sounds better. But so what I wanted to do tonight, we're going to talk about the crap-ass education system here in the United States and pretty much the rest of the Western world. It kind of seems like it's all going to hell, all by the same people. First thing I want to do is I have a interview with a woman named Charlotte Eisenberg. Not Eisenberg. Why do I keep saying Eisenberg? Eiserbit. Every time I see your name, I think it's Eisenberg. I just look at it. It's like, it looks like it should be Eisenberg, but it's not. It's Eiserbit. Eiserbit or Eiserbit. Either way. Yeah, she's a big opponent of the education system going on nowadays. And it's funny because she actually used to work for the Department of Education during the Reagan administration. And she also worked for the Department of State. So she's kind of an insider that kind of came out and goes, you know, what they're doing is a bunch of crap. And they're doing it intentionally. All right, so I'll play this. It's from We Are Change. It doesn't really matter where the interview came from. Just mostly her talking anyway. So it's a pretty good interview. It's about 8 minutes long, so it's not too long.
They're looking at you as a cog in the wheel, in the machine.
Yeah.
You're being trained, not educated. This is shocking, and I've not said this publicly until this minute.
This is Luke Radowski of WeAreChange.org. I'm here with Charlotte Isabee, who's an American whistleblower who worked for the U.S. Department of Education. Now, Charlotte, can you tell us specifically what was your position and what did you uncover in the U.S. Department of Education?
Well, my position was very, very important, although I did not have the credentials for it. I just, the hand of God put me into the Office of Educational Research and Improvement as Senior Policy Advisor.
And what year was this?
In 1981.
So this was Reagan?
Under Reagan. And I just happened to get plopped into that slot that ordinarily in the past would have been held by the former president of Harvard or Stanford or Columbia, whatever. And so I had access to all the old plans and the new, all of which were geared towards limited learning for lifelong labor, basically, which is what we're looking at today through school choice, tax-funded school choice. That's putting it in a nutshell. It's been the plan ever since the late 1890s.
So it's deliberately...
Yes.
Lowering the educational system so we would have a dumbed-down public. Why would they do this?
Well,
what's your rationale for this?
Well, because they want workers. They want worker bees. They don't want intelligent people, you know, if you know what's going on, you might want to do something about it.
Yeah.
They don't want individualists. They want collectivists. They want people that can be dictated to, moved around on the... Slavery, basically.
Yeah.
It is definitely the plan, and it will put all of us worldwide under the umbrella of the, they'll call it school district, lifelong, with all the services, health services, transportation, take grandma to see the leaves in the autumn, workforce training, leisure, arts and all will be under the umbrella of the school district, the community school, they call it. This is not new. It's been planned ever since the beginning of the last century, funded by the Mott Foundation.
Wow.
Now all the other foundations are into it, too. Now, this is the long-term plan that very little people know about. You can see one block of it, parents know, with school-based clinics.
Yeah.
That gives you a good idea.
Now, if I could ask you, when you were in the Department of Education, what was the biggest piece of evidence you found proving everything that you're talking about now?
Well, when Ronald Reagan, they had this, what was it called, private sector initiative, the White House private sector initiative. I went over there and I said, what are you doing? Looks like you're merging the public and private sector. And I said, isn't that corporate fascism? And they said, I don't think anybody looks at it that way. Well, that was it.
Yeah.
That was, under Reagan, the system broke. That was Cap Weinberger, Mad Meese, together. They decided to change America. The same thing Carnegie Corporation called for in 1934.
Yeah.
And we can trace it all the way through to right now. Mark Tucker, the school to work agenda, and the school choice agenda. Without it, they cannot put this in, because they need every single heartbeat on this planet.
So you're telling me the Carnegie Foundation and other elites are involved,
yes,
in influencing our U.S. Educational system in order to dumb us down. Now, the Carnegie Foundation is known to many people outside who don't know of many things,
right,
as this great organization that helps and does
everything else.
But what is the true agenda of these elites and people like the Carnegie families
right
and
the
Rockefeller
beginning.
Families?
Right from the beginning.
Yeah.
They have really, you can go all the way back to the 1700s. You know, with Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati, and then Karl Marx in 1848 with a copied Weishaupt's work. And then you go to the Order at Yale, too. I have the document out of Phi Delta Kappa, how they would change education to performance-based. Now, they couldn't get away with that with the white community, the good, you know, our schools. The whites would have all said, go away. But they knew they could use the minorities, so they did. And they started that with Mastery Learning in Chicago. And half of the inner city kids in the freshman class dropped out.
Yeah.
And even Education Week said, which is a professional journal, they called it a human tragedy of enormous proportions. But that didn't stop them from using this non-competitive individual education plan, Skinnerian, dumbed-down curriculum, because they had to perfect it over a period of 30 years with the minorities in order to move it to all of us, which is what they're putting in all the schools now. James Block, one of the leading honchos in the Mastery Learning Skinner direct instruction movement, he said, I don't know of a single inner city school that has not experimented with mastery learning. That's the thing that took all the Chicago kids down. They had to have an excuse to break the system down and to change it. And they used, you know, integration first.
Yeah.
And then Bloom's Chicago Mastery Learning. And if it had been a disaster, why did they continue using it in every inner city school? And where they had evaluation of the Skinner method in the inner city, it would say the kids may not have learned to read better, but we did do a lot of restructuring in the school system, which was what they were looking for. They couldn't have cared less about the minorities going down the tubes.
Mm-hmm.
Zero.
My last question is, going through the whole educational system, what's one important thing that was taken away and replaced with that you think is most detrimental to the learning of our youth?
Individualism. The importance of the individual. And thinking, and I think that basically was it. Everything, it was more cooperative learning. The whole plan was a collectivist education system. A friend of mine, brilliant Australian, she was at a conference of community educators in the 70s. And all these guys and gals, and it was on community education. We killed it in Maine in the 70s. Which is this lifelong learning stuff under the umbrella of school district. Unbelievable. So one of the educators says to the guy, what is this you're talking about, community ed? And he said, it's a Chinese communist system. No more comment, huh?
Charlotte Isby, The links to your website are in the description. It's an honor and pleasure being able to talk to you.
Thank you
so much for all your brave work.
Well, appreciate that very much.
I
wish that I had a different message, but, you know, you can't change things. You can't change things unless you know what they are. How do you fight something if you don't know what you're fighting?
All right. So that was that interview with Charlotte Isery. And one thing I want everybody to take out of this show tonight, and pretty much the main topic of tonight, is the powers that be, so to say, in this country, you know, for the past 100 years or so, basically made it their plan to just make worker bees out of all of us. You know, just make the old surf plantation sort of model that they had, you know, back in the Middle Ages. It's pretty much what they have been doing, you know, pretty much through the history of this country, mostly. Like I said, it's about the last 100 years or so. They just kind of want to make slaves of all of us, and it was actually by design. So I got the first article I got here is called "The Dumbing Down of America by Design." It actually was written by Joachim Hagopin. I'm not even sure who that is. Doesn't really matter. Actually, no, I did look him up. He's like some truther guy. I think he's like a patriotard, something like that. Anyways, well, this is from the globalresearch.org. That's a pretty good site if you want to look up different things. This was written on August 14th, 2014. So it really wasn't that long ago. It's about a year ago. So it starts out, this presentation focuses on the myriad of ways in which the powers that be in the United States have systematically dumbing down Americans as a society for a very long time. All by meticulously calculated design. Originally, the term dumbing down was used as a slang expression in 1933 by film screenwriters to mean revising the script so as to appeal to the lower education or intelligence. So, since they used the term in the film industry, I could only assume that it was the Jews that, you know, used the term dumbing down. Got to make it a little bit easier for the goy to understand. Actually, I got a call here. All ones, pick him up. He's got a comment or a question. All ones, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Okay.
I'm just listening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. So I'll get back to this. The most obvious example of how Americans have been dumbed down is through the nation's failed education system. At one time, not too long ago, America reigned supreme as a leading model for the rest of the world, providing the best quality free public K-12 education on the planet. But over the last many decades, while much of the rest of the world has been passing us by, it seems an insidious federal agenda has been implemented to condition and brainwash a population of mindless robotic citizenry that simply does what it's told, and of course the brainwashing commences early in American schools. Over numerous decades, a grand experiment engaging in social engineering with America's youth has been steadily working to homogenize a lowest common denominator product of subpar mediocrity, creating generations of young Americans who can neither read nor write nor think for themselves in any critical manner. According to a study last year by the U.S. Department of Education, 19% of U.S. high school graduates cannot read. You know, I thought that kind of sounded far-fetched and maybe a little high, so I actually looked it up, and it was actually true. The U.S. Department of Education did put out a study in study in 2013 that said 19% of high school graduates can't read. How the fuck do you graduate high school without being able to read? The majority of high school, not even high school, your whole 12 years of school is mostly reading. How do you get that? How do you get through 12 years of school without knowing how to fucking read? It's like, anyways. So 21% of adults read below a fifth grade level. That's not really surprising. You look at the newspapers and magazines, and even, you know, the what they pass off as books nowadays. It seems pretty much not too much above a fifth grade level. Well, these alarming rates have not changed in the last 10 years. The international test results from the 2012 PISA indicate American students are lagging behind virtually all developed nations, even more than in the past. China topped all 65 nations, while U.S. teenagers again scored at or below average in math, reading, and science. That is because the current educational system is no longer about learning the ABCs, but simply cranking out a subclass of workforce laborers. This tragic fall from grace of America's once great educational system has education researcher Cynthia Weatherly referring to America's current education system as limited learning for lifelong labor. But this planned system, featuring a planned global economy and a planned global education system, has been promoted for well over a century. The Carnegie Foundation outlined its explicit roadmap for absolute oligarch control way back in the 1930s. As the first elected UNESCO director, General British Professor Julian Huxley, brother of Brave New World's Eldos, in 1949, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization pumped out pamphlets expounding the importance that children be educated devoid of any national alliance, patriotism, or family loyalties identified as the bravest barriers or the biggest barriers to their demonic ambitions. Here's a quote: as long as the child breathes the poison air of nationalism, education and world-mindedness can only produce precarious results. So there you go. You got another case of the chosen tribe. You can only assume, because that's where most of this comes from. Sounds pretty Marxist to me. Based on my personal experience working with the working with America's broken child welfare system, several weeks ago, I wrote an article on current child welfare system's assault on the modern American family. That assault was part of a wider, across-the-board assault by the entire U.S. government. The Federalists in Washington have been busily mounting an assault on the American family through the state-run public education system as well. Like the separation of church and state, the Constitution explicitly calls for specific delineation between the federal government to stay out of the business of education, traditionally leaving up within the sovereignty of the states and local communities to govern. However, just as the U.S. Constitution has been under assault, Washington is now unlawfully dictating mandates to the 1,600 U.S. school districts that they must comply with in order to avoid the cutoff of federal dollars. Thus, local school districts throughout this nation are presently under a subversive assault from the long arm of authoritarian government. In the Orwellian doublespeak deception of school choice, public tax-funded privatized programs like Common Core have been sold as answering the need for higher educational standards. Should a school district even accept $1 from the federal government, it automatically relinquishes control to the feds, thus providing no choice to the locals. With 43 out of the 50 states already signed up for Common Core, public education run by local communities and states is clearly under siege. The federal agenda is to abolish local-run school boards, abandon the letter grade system of A through F, and seize control over the curriculum. Because, of course, we can't give children A's through F's because, you know, the children that don't do as good, you know, they get C's or D's or F's. They'll feel bad. We can't have that. Concealed in the fine print is the not-so-thinly-veiled Trojan horse promoting the same New World Order that Dewey and Huxley were driving at nearly seven decades earlier. Like it or not, even the nation's homeschoolers, private schools, and students in the seven states not adopting Common Core are being impacted as textbook companies have rushed to align their books according to the dogma of the Common Core standards. The embedded Common Core doctrine handed down from Dewey's Progressive Education is designed to program and prepare children's impressionable minds toward accepting the notion of collectivism. The group mind is deemed far more important than the individual mind to the extent that a child's value is only as good as the value the child can bring to the group. As an individual, one carries little intrinsic value as a human life without the greater context as the worker bee sacrifices for the maintenance of the group. The heavy focus on the public education today is primarily limited to standardized test performance and the proliferation of privatized charter schools, complete with private contractors teaching the tests, usurping the authority at all levels from state to local communities to individual teachers' lesson plans to homeschooling parents, largely replaced by instructional software programs. And, you know, the main thing I have a problem with these standardized tests is pretty much the whole way, like when I was in school, all you did is they gave you, a chapter in history. So you got that chapter in history. You have to read that chapter, and then you take a test. That's it. You never have to remember any of it ever again. You kind of memorize a little piece here and there, and then take a test. Memorize the little piece, take a test. It's just memorization for just as long enough to get that grade. You know, they don't teach you anything about critical thinking or logic, anything that would actually help you in life. All they do is teach you a little memorization just long enough to prove to the state that you know what the state thinks you're supposed to know. All right. A little thought or consideration by today's education top-down policymakers is ever given to those students who happen to score low on all these tests. To make matters worse, scores are being made public access now, which only traumatizes those children and schools scoring far below average, which mostly are your run-of-the-mill multi-culti schools, your schools with high diversity. Being branded as less than carriers stigmatizes effects of shame and low self-esteem that can both hurt and haunt a person for their entire life. Test scores determine placement, and too often those scoring lower in the youngest grades again can be branded for the remainder of their public education years and beyond for life. Tests always possess limitations on what they mean and measure. For super intelligent individuals, experience test anxiety and perform poorly, yet with so much riding on test scores today and the damaging baggage that results from lower test scores and lower placements, this current system appears to be doing far more harm than good. And then that is rarely, if ever, taken into account when the powerful few control the lives of so many. Now, the other thing, when I went to school, they used to bore the hell out of me. I used to sit there all day, and I remember specifically in English class, I would sit there, and I'd just sit there and draw, and it was funny, because you'd go around, and, you know, you'd be reading Shakespeare or something, right? Everybody would go around and read a paragraph or a section or whatever. And I'd just be sitting there drawing, just listening. Because I was bored. You just can't sit there and read, you know, follow along in the book. And the teacher would call on me, like she was calling me out. And then I'd look, and I'm like, yeah, we're right there. I know, I used to get so bored in school. It's like they don't teach you anything. And they keep going over the same stuff, you know, year after year. And it gets pretty monotonous. Because they don't really cater to individual needs. And that's the other thing, now that I think about it, when, you know, they keep saying we need more money for schools and more money for this and that and more teachers and can't have oversized classrooms and all this and that. You know, I remember when I went to school, there were like 30 or 40 kids in a class. You only had one teacher for the whole classroom. Now they got teachers and teacher's aides and like 3 or 4 people in the fucking classroom for like 20 kids. Because all they're doing is coddling these damn kids. So they can't figure out how to do anything out on their own. But that's all by design. So I'll get back into this. The educational system for the first 20, or the educational system of the 21st century has been ushered in by the likes of former President Bush's No Child Left Behind program as a transparent corporatization, privatization takeover. Bush's younger brother, Neil, after being banned from the bacon industry after his savings and loan scandals in the late 80s, has been making a killing with his educational software company, Ignite, that promises higher test scores. Behind the doublespeak deceit of No Child Left Behind, which is pretty much what they always do, they always have these little phrases and nice little packaged branding for these things, which actually means absolutely nothing of what they're actually trying to achieve. You know, like the Patriot Act. There's nothing patriotic about the fucking thing. Actually, I'll start that sentence over. Behind the doublespeak deceit of No Child Left Behind, Washington began blackmailing school districts across America with the threat of cutting off federal funds should the test scores fail to make the cut. So then, of course, we have to coddle the kids who can't fucking read by the time they get into high school. That still blows my mind. How could you go for 12 years of school and they just push you along and you can't read? 19% of people who graduate, how do you graduate? I know, like, my senior year, I took a bunch of stupid, crappy classes that, you know, were pretty easy and lax because, you know, I took, you know, all the other prerequisite stuff, like all the science stuff and math and stuff like that. You know, the first 3 years I was in school. So my senior year, you know, I had like four art classes a day. And I think I had an English class. I can't remember what else I had, but it was pretty easy, pretty simple. Actually, the English class I had was a sci-fi class. And actually, because I wanted to take the mythology class, but the mythology class was full. So then I took the sci-fi class. Pretty much all we did was watch fucking movies in that class all day. I think we read... I think we read like one book. I think it was like an Asimov book. I only remember reading one book in that class. Rest of the time, we watched Star Trek, and I remember one time we watched Hitchcock's Birds, or The Birds. Wow, that was a crappy class. Anyways, where was I? This governmental design for public education to move away from actual academic learning to become a mere pipeline for training a docile and obedient future workforce has only accelerated on steroids during the Obama regime. With Obama's current Secretary of Education and former CEO of Chicago Public Schools, Arne Duncan, and current Chicago Mayors Rahm Emanuel, as both Obama and Duncan's strong-arm enforcer, the scenario being played out in the murderous mean streets of Chicago is igniting the growing national debate. The federal government busily ramrods its agenda, pushing standardized tests and test performance as the package panacea in the form of Common Core standards and privatized charter schools under the guise of tax-paid public education. Of course, school privatization in many districts around this Christian nation... I'm going to skip this part. Should actually just took that one out. I am going to read that. I thought it was something else. Never mind. I was thinking of something else. Of course, public school privatization in many districts around this Christian nation also means creationism is now being taught instead of evolution. Of course, this means systematic dumbing down of our educational system also permeates a parallel process in the dumbing down of textbooks sold in schools. The omission of truth and inclusion of false disinformation and propaganda in school textbooks are just another form of indoctrinated mind control. This lopsided war between propaganda school brainwashing as a brave new world youth and the local school boards, teachers, and parents battling for their lives to maintain what little choice they still have with their children is yet another pathetic cautionary tale of what the oligarchy agenda is doing to destroy America today. When those who are endowed with optimal energy and often become restless and bored with the duller tedium of their common denominator factory education, and especially if they freely exercise an individual mind or will of their own in the classroom, which was the example I was making earlier about me just sitting there drawing in English class, they're customarily misdiagnosed and branded with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and given drug lobotomies for control purposes so the school staff can manage the herd more easily sometimes or something is diabolically wrong with the system. And that's the other thing. They got all these kids on meds. You know, they're hyperactive. Well, fucking kids are hyperactive. Kids want to run around and do stuff. They don't want to sit there and, you know, read a book all day and listen to some teacher tell them about math or whatever. You know, little kids, especially like elementary school kids, you know, that's what kids do. They want to go run around and play all day. They don't want to sit there and listen to somebody. So, yeah, they're going to be hyperactive. Kids are hyperactive. You don't have to give them a drug to lobotomize them and make them sit there all day. Tell them to shut the fuck up and sit down. That's what they did when I was a kid. If you didn't do it, they told your dad, and your dad smacks you upside the head. It worked fine. Right. When teachers are burdened with overcrowding in the classroom with 30 or more students, as is extremely common today, it's a setup for failure to provide an enriching learning environment and typically leads to the above scenario of a false ADHD drug-pushing classroom culture. So, yeah, you got 30 or more kids in the class, and, you know, they're all bouncing around because they're bored as hell. They just give them a bunch of drugs, and they can just sit there and make a bunch of drooling zombies. Yet, this is typical of what happens to children and young people who are generally sharper in intellect and creativity and are inadequately engaged, stimulated, and challenged in the classroom. Instead of encouraging the gifted by teaching to their strengths, too often they are responded by punitively either overly frustrated and or rigid authoritarian adults bent on maintaining some semblance of control. As a longtime therapist of children and adolescents, I have repeatedly observed this overreactivity by adults in our educational system, often caused by the fatality flawed system more than the overloaded teacher entrusted to educate and develop the intellectual capacity of our young. Instead, they're too frequently squelched, impeded, and destroy it. The one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter system stifles learning, cognition, and intellectual development and creativity, rewarding those who acquiesce and simply do what they're told as good little boys and girls on their way to being good little employees and citizens who are so easily manipulated, controlled, and subdued, they become the lifeless walking dead who merely go through the daily motions on autopilot, too beaten down, dumb, or fearful. Which is actually, I would say, that's not too far from the truth. And that's not really an exaggeration. I see people like that every day. And it kind of gets on my nerves. And I don't know. It kind of makes me mad. You see these people, you know, probably in the place you work. They just kind of go through the motions. They half-ass do their job just enough to get by. And it's not because they're lazy. It's just because they're too fucking stupid to know any better. That's another rant for a different time. A substate of quality education should teach the curious developing mind to be critical and discriminating, willing to ask questions, challenging the status quo of preconceived suppositions and accepted dogma. And then when we have a leader like President Obama telling the graduating seniors last year at Ohio State University to reject what they may hear about the government's tyranny, in effect dictating how they should, as college-educated adults, should really think, especially when it's a complete and utter lie. Again, another disturbing warning sign that there is something extremely wrong with both the educational as well as the political system. And again, more overwhelming evidence of a systematic and relentless dumbing down of America. All right. Along with war criminals, Henry Kissinger, perhaps the most emboldened globalist associated with a predominant role in a U.S. president's innermost circle, is Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. I don't even know how you say that goddamn name. Nobody does. I've heard of Zbigniew. I think it's Zbigniew. But it seems like everybody just mumbles it. Like nobody really knows how to pronounce it. It's like... Blah, blah, blah. Anyways. All right. For years, he has regularly come out with the very matter-of-fact, yet incredible, astute, and even prophetic observation about the oligarchy agenda. Back in 1970, in his book Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, Brzezinski envisioned, quote, "The technotronic era involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled society. Such a society would be dominated by an elite, unrestrained by traditional values. Soon it will be possible to assert almost continuous surveillance over every citizen and maintain up-to-date complete files containing even the most personal information about the citizen. These files would be subject to instantaneous retrieval by the authorities," unquote. I don't know how the hell he could figure that out in 1970, but that sounds pretty much like what's going on today. Welcome to the 21st century. Brzezinski goes on to conclude that the American people will become brainwashed in giving up control of their lives to the elite, that they will reach a point when even they are so dumbed down and confused that they are unable to think individually for themselves. So they can only repeat what has been downloaded into them by a constant repetition of what is driven into their heads by the mainstream outlets. In effect, people defer the task of cognitive assessment and analysis of what is most important and real to what is simply communicated and propagated to them by the media. All right, check the cohort here. I think that's Jeb. If he has a question or comment, you just press 1. Actually, the next section I got here is a little bit longer. It actually goes over the history of the educational system in the United States. So I think I'll take a break. Actually, yeah. So I'm going to play... Where is that? Yeah, I'm going to play Class of 99. Of course, if we're going to do a show on education, I got to play that Pink Floyd song, Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. But this is actually the cover by Class of 99. So I'll be back in about 4 minutes.
Leave them kids alone.
right. Hello and welcome back to Radio Werewolf. I'm your host, Dion. Now we're going to go over the history of the educational system in America. Find out, you know, who's behind this mess. It's always the same people's, you know, behind everything else. But, so this, I actually got this from Waking Times. This is written by Jamie Lee. Very few have any idea how our modern public educational system was born and who drafted it, funded, designed our current education system and what their stated plans and goals were for public education. Many feel that given the amount of money we spend on public schools that we should be producing much higher quality students that are equal to or superior to education in other countries. Yet that was never the intention from the original framers of our educational system. In fact, the system is working exactly as those few men of enormous wealth had planned out nearly a century ago. And that's the other thing. We spend more on education than, like, just pretty much any country in the world. But we're, like, at the bottom. And they can't figure out what the problem is. I'm pretty sure they know what the problem is that, you know, it's not designed that way. This is a quote from John D. Rockefeller at the General Education Board in 1906. Quote, "In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfectly docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions of intellectual and character education fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into men of learning or philosophers or men of science. We have not to raise up them from authors, educators, poets, or men of letters, great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, statesmen, politicians, creatures of whom we have ample supply. The task is simple. We will organize children and teach them in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way." Unquote. In the dawn of the 20th century, a revolutionary new industrialized society was in the process of forming. Only a very few men began to make vast fortunes in the fields of coal, steam, oil, transportation, and finance, as man's ability to mass harvest nature's resources through advancing technological engineering created overnight oligarchs. No one amassed more wealth more quickly than J.D. Rockefeller through his oil interests. In the early 1900s, he amassed the equivalent of $663 billion in today's dollars. Other industrialists created more great wealth for themselves with legendary names like J.P. Morgan, Carnegie, Mellon, Guggenheim, Vanderbilt, Peabody, and Ford. Today we know them by the foundations they created, totally over $550 billion in today's dollars, and by their vast corporate holdings and businesses. With their incredible sudden wealth also came enormous tax bills. Their solution was to create for themselves, with the help of bought politicians, tax-exempt nonprofit organizations, or NGOs. In 1900, there were 21 corporate NGOs. By 1990, some 50,000 had spawned. Through the creation of NGOs, not only could they shelter their wealth, but were also able to develop a new science called scientific social engineering to influence federal, state, and local politicians and the public at large for their own wishes, desires, and needs. Through newly created social propaganda campaigns created by the likes of Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays, the fathers of marketing and propaganda, respectively, they were able to regularly sell the public at will on the idea that their NGOs were solely philanthropic and for the good of all. In his book, PR, A Social History of Spin, Stuart Ewen writes, novel strategies of social management and the connection of a technical elite might be able to engineer social order were becoming more attractive. Accompanying a democratic current of social analysis that sought to educate the public at large, another, more Kabbalistic, tradition of social scientific thought was emerging. One that saw the study of society as a tool by which the technocratic elite could help serve the interest of vested power. The titans of industry, as the PR men dubbed them, were at the top, and the plan was to stay at the top for generations to come. The strategy was to keep the working middle class from ever rising to power through controlling of the public education system in the United States. When you are at the top, you spend a lot of time and money making sure you stay at the top. And the last thing these robber barons would allow is for the uprising of the middle class into their hierarchy. The ability to deal with people is as purchasable a commodity as sugar or coffee, and I will pay more for that ability than any other under the sun. That's by John D. Rockefeller. In 1905, J.D. Rockefeller kickstarted the creation of the General Education Board. Rockefeller alone, with $1905 dollars, initially gifted $1 million, then increased to $10 million in 1907, later a further sum of $32 million, and through subsequent decades granted more than $7.5 billion, with subsequent money buys, subsequent influence, and loyalty. In 1913, they must have been a really busy time that year. In 1913, the 62nd Congress created a commission to investigate the role of the newly created NGO foundations. The commissions, after a year of testimony, concluded, quote, the domination of men in whose hands the final control of a large part of American industry rests is not limited to their employees, but is being rapidly extended to control the education and social services of the nation. The giant foundation exercises enormous power through direct use of its funds, free of any statutory entanglements, so they can be directly and precisely to the levers of a situation. This power, however, is substantially increased by building collateral alliances insulated from criticism and scrutiny, unquote. The Guggenheim Foundation agreed to award fellowships to historians recommended by the Carnegie Endowment. Gradually, through the 1920s, they assembled a group of 20 promising young academics and took them to London. There, they briefed them on what was expected of them when they became professors of American history. That 20 were the nucleus of what would eventually become the American Historical Association. The Guggenheim Foundation also endowed the American Historical Association with $400,000 at that time. Just so everybody's clear, Guggenheim is a Jew. So it turns out that the rich Jew actually founded the American Historical Association, which is where most of our mainstream history originates from. Actually, all of it pretty much originates from the American Historical Association. Anything other than that doesn't see the light of day. By 1950, the Rockefeller Foundation endowed Columbia Teachers College in New York City, formerly named the Russell Teachers College, and produced one-third of all students, one-third of all presidents of teacher training institutions, one-fifth of all American public school teachers, and one-quarter of all superintendents. So the Rockefeller Foundation made sure through Columbia Teachers College in New York City that they had a pretty good grip on the educational system with the teacher training and teachers in general and superintendents. J.D. Rockefeller and family additionally funded and founded the University of Chicago, Rockefeller University, which focused on offering only postgraduate and postdoctoral education. The Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, Harvard School of Public Health, as well as the Rockefeller University Press. They also controlled and continue to maintain ownership control in school textbook companies and scholastic literature copyright uses in the medical, in the public school system, thus being able to direct the historical narrative used in schools through Guggenheim's American Historical Society. Additionally, through use of political favors and influence, as well as the structuring of the public educational taxes through property ownership, these few NGO foundations were able to mold educational policy and control the flow of funds to school districts and community colleges at the federal levels. The power of the individual large foundations is enormous. Its various forms of patronage carry with them the elements of thought control. It exerts immense influence on educational processes, the educational institutions. It is capable of invisible coercion. It can materially predetermine the development of social and political concepts, academic opinion, thought leadership, and public opinion. The power to influence national policy is amplified tremendously when foundations act in concert. there's such a concentration of foundation power in the United States operating educational and social sciences with a gigantic aggregate of capital and income. This interlock has some of the characteristics of an intellectual cartel. It operates in parts through certain intermediary organizations supported by the foundations. It has ramifications in almost every phase of education. And that was a quote from John Taylor Gatto, author of The Underground History of Education and thrice New York Teacher of the Year. It's funny how it seems like the people who are in education come out and kind of spill the beans about what's going on. Kind of need more people like that, especially in the baking industry and so forth. The political world. In 1954, a special congressional committee investigated the interlocking web of tax-exempt foundations to see what impact their grants were having on American people. The Reese Committee, as it became known, stumbled onto the fact that some of the foundations had embarked upon a gigantic project to rewrite American history and incorporate it into new textbook. Norman Dodd, the Reese Committee's research director, found in the archives in the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace the following remarkable statement of purpose. Quote, the only way to maintain control of the population is to obtain control of the education in the U.S. They realized that this was a prodigious task, so they approached the Rockefeller Foundation with the suggestion that they go in tandem, so the portion of education which could be considered domestically orientated could be taken over by the Rockefeller Foundation. And the portion which orientated to international matters be taken over by the Carnegie Endowment. Unquote. So there you got the two foundations kind of splitting up. It's like you take the domestic one and the other guy can take the international one. Here's another quote by John Taylor Gatto in his book, The Weapons of Mass Education. Schools were designed by Horace Mann and others to be instruments of the scientific management of mass population. And it's funny, I just kind of thought of this. If they take control of the educational system, you know, this is back in the early 1900s when they started doing this. That was pretty much before there was like any major media. You know, they didn't have TV or radio back then. All they really had was newspapers. And, you know, back then, if you ever look at a newspaper from back then, they pretty much just gave you the facts. They didn't give you a bunch of crappy ass opinions like they do nowadays, where they put stuff in there that doesn't have anything to do with anything. So the media, there wasn't really much of a media back then. So the only way you're going to change people's perceptions and outlooks on life and, you know, all that is to go after the educational system, because that was the only means that you could get to, you know, shaping the minds of the populace. But nowadays, they do it with the educational system first. Then they go to the colleges, which is even worse. You got the media, which is just as bad as the colleges, pretty much. All right. The advent of compulsory education in the United States originated out of Prussia, which was within the area of Germany today. The Prussian monarchy divided the education system into three groups: those who were to make policy, those who would assist the policymakers, the engineers, doctors, lawyers, and architects, and the rest would be common laborers. Using the basic philosophy prescribing the quote-unquote duties of the state, combined the John Locke's view from 1690 that children are a blank slate, and lessons from Rousseau on how to write on that slate. Prussia established a three-tiered educational system that was considered scientific in nature. Work began in 1807, and the system was in place by 1819. An important component of the Prussian system was how it defined for the child what was to be learned, what was to be thought, how long to think about it, and when a child was allowed to think about something else. In 1914, Edward Everett was the first American to go to Prussia for a doctorate in philosophy, or a PhD. Yeah, before that, there wasn't really anything as a PhD. He eventually became governor of Massachusetts. During the next 30 years or so, a line of American dignitaries went to Germany to earn degrees, which was a German invention. Horace Mann, instrumental in the development of educational systems in America, was among them. Those who earned degrees in Germany came back to the United States and staffed all of the major universities. In 1850, Massachusetts and New York utilized the Prussian system, as well as promoting the concept that the state is the father of children. Kind of sounds like when Hillary Clinton said that all children are... I can't remember what she said now. She kind of popped in my head. Like, what, all children or children of the community or some bullshit like that. Some more Marxist propaganda. Horace Mann's sister, Elizabeth Peabody, from the Peabody Foundation, saw to it that after the Civil War, the Prussian system, taught in mostly the northern states, was integrated into the conquered South between 1865 and 1918. Most of the compulsory schooling laws designed to implement the system were passed in 1900. By 1900, all the PhDs in the United States were trained in Prussia. This project also means that one-room schoolhouses had to go, for it fostered independence, and they were eventually wiped out. The implementation of the German educational system in the United States meant some initial resistance. In Carnegie's hometown of Gary, Indiana, the system was implemented between 1910 and 1916, mostly through the efforts of William Wirt, the school superintendent. It involved no academic endeavor whatsoever. It worked so well in supplying willing workers for the steel mill that it was decided by Carnegie to bring the system to New York City. In 1917, they initiated a program in New York in 12 schools, with the objective of enlarging the program to encompass 100 schools and eventually all schools in New York. William Wirt came to New York to supervise that transition. Here's a little funny story. Unfortunately for Carnegie, the population of the 12 schools were predominantly composed of Jewish immigrants who innately recognized what was being done and the nature of the new educational system. 3 weeks of riots followed, and editorials in the New York Times were very critical of the plan. Over 200 Jewish school children were thrown in jail. They threw kids in jail. The Jews knew what was happening because they, you know, they're probably the ones that came up with the plan in the first place. I didn't actually look into the Prussian system. I had enough here to go off of. Actually, originally I had way too much. I had about 50 pages of notes, and I kind of dwindled it down to 37. So, I thought about looking into the Prussian system to see what that was all about, where that came from. And actually, next week's show, I already figured it's going to be kind of an addendum to this show. So I'm going to go through the theory of, the trivium, going over what should be taught in schools today, but isn't taught at all. More taught on the memory/test-taking model that they do now. So next week's show, I was going to do an addendum going over the trivium and critical thinking and things like that. So maybe I'll look into where the Prussian system originated from and who were the big thinkers behind that. So they tried to do this in New York schools to predominantly Jewish schools, and the Jews figured out what was going on and started rioting for 3 weeks. If only we can get that kind of activism going today over this Common Core nonsense. Where was I? The whole political structure of New York that had tried this scheme were thrown out of office. Were thrown out of office during the next election. A book describes this scenario called The Great School Wars. It was written by Diane Radovich. Curiously, William Wirt was committed to an insane asylum around 1930 after making public speeches about his part in a large conspiracy to bring about a controlled state in the hands of certain people. And then he died 2 years later. So the guy who they kind of put in charge of supervising this whole damn thing ended up in a nut house. And then he died. That wasn't suspicious at all. This is a quote from the National Education Association meeting of 1913. It's a quote. We view with alarm the activity of the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundation's agencies, not in any way responsible to the people, in their efforts to control the policies of our state educational institutions, to fashion after their conception and to standardize our courses of study, and to surround the institutions with conditions which menace true academic freedom, and to defeat the primary purpose of democracy as heretofore preserved and violate in our common schools, normal schools, and universities, unquote. See, even people don't talk like that nowadays. People don't use big words like that anymore. Heretofore. When's the last time you heard somebody use heretofore? I bet you never heard anybody in your entire life use the word heretofore, and I'm probably not even pronouncing that right. Another great influence on how public education would be directed was John Dewey, known as the father of the progressive education movement, and a great influence on the powerful National Education Association. Mr. Dewey's progressive model of active learning, or pragmatism, promoted a revolt against abstract learning and attempted to make education an effective tool of integrating culture and vocation. Dewey was responsible for developing a philosophical approach to education called experimentalism, which saw education as the basis for democracy. His goal was to turn public schools into indoctrination centers to develop a socialized population that could adapt to an egalitarian state operated by intellectual elites. Thinking for Dewey was a collective phenomenon, disavowing the role of the individual mind in achieving technological and social progress. Dewey promoted the group rather than the teacher and the main source of social control in the schools, denying the ideas of universal principles, natural law, and natural rights. Dewey emphasized social values and taught that life adjustment is more important than academic skills, which is why they got rid of the trivium and critical thinking and all that. It's more important to go with the flow than what you know. I just made that up right now. All right. In his book, The Great Technology, 1933, Harold Rugg elucidated the grand vision. A new public mind is to be created. How? Only by creating tens of millions of individual minds and wielding them into a new social mind. Old stereotypes must be broken up and new climates of opinion formed in the neighborhoods of America. Through the schools of the world, we shall decimate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all these activities of men, one that will postulate the needs of scientific control in the interest of all people, unquote. The Rockefeller endowed Lincoln Experimental School at Columbia Teachers College was the testing ground for Harold Rugg's series of textbooks, which moved 5 million copies by 1940, and millions more after that. In these books, Mr. Rugg advanced this theory: education must be used to condition the people to accept social change. The chief function of schools is to plan the future of society. Like many of his activities over three vital decades on the school front, the notion he must put forth in The Great Technology were eventually translated into practice in urban centers. He advocated that the major task of schools be seen as indoctrinating youth using social science as the core of the school curriculum to bring about the desired climate of political and public opinion. Some attitudes Rugg advocated teaching were reconstruction of the national economic system to provide the center controls and an implementation of the attitude that educators as a group were vastly superior to the priesthood, and to create swiftly a compact body of minority opinion for the scientific reconstruction of a social order. So it sounds like they're trying to bring, you know, more examples of bringing cultural Marxism to America. Money for Rugg's 6 textbooks came from the Rockefeller Foundation's grant to the Lincoln School. He was paid 2 salaries by the foundation, one as an educational psychologist for Lincoln, and the other as a professor of education at Teachers College. In addition to salaries for the secretarial and research services, the General Education Board provide funds equivalent why did I have such a hard time saying that word? Equivalent to $500,000 a year in 2000 purchasing power to produce three books, which were then distributed by the National Education Association. All right. Actually, I'm going to take a break quick right here. This kind of goes over the outlining of what they were trying to do. And it's probably a pretty good point to take a break. Song they're going to play now. Actually, yeah, I'll play this song. This is Mongoloid, which it's by Devo. People don't give Devo enough credit, damn it. All right, I'll be back in about 3.5 minutes. If it plays. All right. Hello and welcome back to Radio Werewolf. I'm your host, Dion. Now we're going to go through kind of the outline of what their focus was. Between the years of 1967 and 1974, teachers training was covertly revamped through the original foundations created in the early 1900s, working with other private foundations. For profit global corporations, certain universities, state education departments, and the U.S. Department of Education. Three critical multi-volume documents were produced. They were called the Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, Designing Education for the Future, and the Behavioral Teacher Education Project. It totaled over 3,000 pages. John Taylor Gatto outlines these three areas of focus. Number one, designing education for the future. They were the collusion with the Federal Education Department and the presumably independent state agencies. They redefined education after the 19th century Germanic fashion. Quoting now from the document, as a means to achieve important economic and social goals for the national character, unquote. And I would hasten to add that none of those goals included the maximum development for your son or daughter. State agencies would henceforth, quote, act as federal enforcers, ensuring compliance of local schools with federal directives, unquote. The document proclaimed that, quote, each state education department must be an agent of change, unquote. Now, who the hell uses terms like agent of change? And proclaimed further, change must be institutionalized. I doubt if an account of this appeared in any newspaper in the state of Vermont, or for that matter, in any newspaper in the country. Education departments were, quote, to lose their identity as well as their authority in order to form a partnership with the federal government, unquote. Here's number two, the Behavioral Teacher Educational Project outlines specific teaching reforms to be forced on the country, unwilling, of course, after 1967. It also sets out in clear language the outlook and intent of its invisible creators. Nothing less than, quoting again, the impersonal manipulation through schooling for a future America in which few would be able to maintain control over their own opinions. In America, which each individual receives at birth a multi-purpose identification number, which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of their underlings. And to expose them to the director's subliminal influence of the state's education department and the federal department acting through those whenever necessary. Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, which has, since its publication, spawned a number of descendant forms like mastery learning, outcome-based education, and school to work, business, government, and economic projects. Dr. Bloom's compilation was a tool, quote, a tool to classify the ways individuals are to act, feel, think as a result of participating in some unit of instruction, unquote. So they're going to tell you and show you how to act and feel and think. I would be dubious if any parent in the United States would send their children to schools under the auspice if they were thinking people. In this fashion, children would learn proper attitudes and have their improper attitudes, which were brought from home, remedied. In all stages of the school, manipulation testing would be essential to locate the child's mind on the official continuum. So you go through school, and they got to show you and teach you how to act properly, and necessary through agents of change. In 1972, Dr. Chester M. Pierce, MD of Harvard University, wrote an article entitled Becoming Planetary Citizens, A Quest for Meaning. In the November 1972 issue of Childhood Education. And then the following are excerpts of that article. Creative Altruism. In the past 40 years, social science experimentation has shown that by age 5, children already have a lot of political attitudes. Regardless of economic or social background, almost every kindergartner has a tenacious loyalty to his country and its leaders. This phenomenon is understandable in the psychological terms of loyalty to a strong father figure and of the need for security. But a child can enter kindergarten with the same kind of loyalty to the earth as his homeland. And, you know, this is another funny thing I just thought of. The term kindergarten, it's a German word. We all know that. But I'm surprised they haven't, you know, changed that term yet. It's still called kindergarten. As far as I know. As far as I know, they still call it kindergarten. But I'm surprised, you know, the cultural Marxists out there haven't changed the name because, you know, it's too German. It might trigger some Jews. Oh, looks like I got a call here. Uh, 661, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Dion, how you doing?
All right.
Good show. I especially enjoyed your show on the MK Ultra program, so I wanted to thank you for that. Did you happen to know that Dion is a village located at the foot of Mount Olympus?
No, I did not.
Yeah?
But
D-I-O-N. It says here on Wikipedia, it's best known for its ancient Macedonian sanctuary of Zeus. So there you go. You unwittingly then picked the perfect name for yourself.
Actually, I didn't pick that name. My dad did. But thanks anyways.
Oh, okay. I had no idea that was your actual name. I'm personally of the opinion it's not the best idea to use your real name, but, you know, it's a great show you do, and I'm sure you thought it out beforehand and everything. I like the research you put into the shows. You were just talking about how they haven't, it startles you that they haven't changed the name kindergarten yet. Well, I'll tell you, they sure are changing a lot of things pertaining to education. I was just speaking with a woman whose son is in college, and his college course bulletin for the upcoming semester course offerings happen to be on the table, okay? And this young guy is studying literature and everything. And I remember when the courses, you know, used to be pertaining to Shakespeare or 19th century romantics or whatnot. But I was amazed. I'm looking at this course offering bulletin. Nearly every single lit course offered was something like female playwrights or advanced African-American studies or, you know, lame gay Jew poets with AIDS or something just so, I mean, you can incorporate female writers into the curriculum. You can incorporate all kind of different ethnicities. I personally am interested in different cultures. And, you know, I like Chinese writers and whatnot, but to name all of these courses specific to anything except white males is such an affront. You know, it's just so insulting. And I recommend anyone check that out who thinks I'm exaggerating. Just go to your local college and look at the liberal arts college course offerings. And you'll see that I'm exaggerating very little here, if at all.
Yeah, I would buy that, because I remember when I went to college, they had courses like that. And that's one of the reasons I left college. It's like, you want me to pay money to sit through this bullshit? Because it was like,
yeah,
it was mandatory. You had to take some sort of, I don't know what the hell you call it, like cultural sensitivity courses or some shit like that.
I remember that too. But, you know, I wasn't an English major or anything, but I did take, you know, some lit electives. And I just remember there were lots of courses on Chaucer and Byron and, you know, all the biggies, all the heavies. And I'm looking at this bulletin and it's like, holy mackerel. You know, almost every single course was something completely exclusive to the traditional canon of Western literature. They've upped it. They've really upped it really several notches on that score.
Right, yeah, they've been doing that for at least the past, I don't know, 60, 70 years. Yeah, they keep doing that more and more.
And I'll tell you, it's ironic for me to mention such a thing, because I do enjoy reading about different cultures and whatnot, but to be just so exclusionary now, you know, in a country founded by the progeny of white Europeans, it's just such an insult. And the fact that these kids sit there and put up with it, you know, with notable exceptions. Like, you can look at the work that Angelo Gage was doing there, as was featured on one of the recent Renegade programs, you know, going into the colleges and taking them to task for their anti-white propaganda. Got to give them credit for that.
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, I appreciate the research you put into these shows, and sort of reminiscent to some extent of what Giuliani does. You got your notes there, and I don't know, maybe you go hiking and biking too, I don't know, but there's a real similarity there in the overall approach, I think.
I guess I got to go off on less rants than he does, but...
Well, you know, he is really adept at that. I love his rants, though. And, you know, I want the guy to be happy. I really like him. But it's just great when I'll turn on his show and he's just so despondent and cynical. I mean, it's just, you don't get that anywhere else, really, to that extent. It's just, it's refreshing, you know, really refreshing stuff. But
I catch most of his shows, but it depends on what the topic is, I guess.
Go on. I'm sorry.
Sometimes, you know, you kind of get sick of hearing him talk about Christianity all the time, which I know it's important. It's important that people understand what's going on, but, you know, sometimes he takes it too far.
Well, you may think so. I relish those shows. I don't think you can take it far enough. What I don't like is the superficial skaters, you know, the people who are always on the surface of things. You know, they're obsessed with Sandy Hook being a false flag, but meanwhile they're worshiping Yahweh. I mean, this is just pointless and insipid, and this sort of thing has to have the Jews just laughing into their sleeves. It really does. I mean, to just sit there and pick at the skin and never get to the main meat of the issue, this is the norm. So I appreciate Giuliani just being obsessed with that, you know. But hey,
right.
I kind of hear what you're saying, but there's no hope for any kind of liberation without slaying that fire-breathing monster Yahweh in the sky. There just isn't.
You know, I understand. I understand that, but sometimes you just get sick of hearing about it. You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's it's just mind-boggling that centuries of our ancestors just fell for that, and it took how many generations for someone to come out of a family and actually realize there's something wrong with that religion and actually read the book that they espouse believing in. And you know, I've shown these passages to my parents, grandparents, and they're just shocked beyond belief. They just spent their entire lives not even knowing those passages are in there. And then none of them have any arguments. One of the things Giuliani does when he rants is he says, "Call me up, Christians, I dare you." No one ever does.
No.
You know, once in a while, a Jewish person will step to the plate and call him, but no, they know better. They know better than to get in the ring with the Yahweh Slayer.
Right.
Yeah, I guess. Apart.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, he had a Jew call in. That was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I actually addressed that by calling Charlie today. We were having some laughs and discussion about that, but funny you should mention that. Anyway, great show, and I see you're down to the last 7 minutes. You probably want to wrap this up with your featured content, so I should probably get off the line here. Let me ask you one last thing. I wouldn't mention any names, even stage names, even radio names, or locations, because I just don't think it's wise. But I think you may have done a show long ago that was mostly like a sort of patriotard show. I mean, it was a good show. And do you remember a caller who called in and told you about the white slave trade in Israel? And
no, I don't think that was me.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, it's quite interesting because sometimes I'll call people that I hear on the regular radio, and I'll tell them to go to this or that site, and then I start to hear them talking quite differently after they do. You know, there's these illuminating experiences. But just like the Bible, which has all this stuff in there about how we're all going to be licking Jew feet for eternity, and none of the Christians see it or notice it or care. It's incredible how much is on the internet now, and most people are oblivious to it.
Right.
There's a lot of optimism I hear bandied around about, oh, yeah, the internet, it's going to save us. Most people don't know any of this shit still. They're just, you know, playing games on their cell phones and checking their tweets. You know what I mean? It's just,
right.
These fucktards never get wise. All right, well, I'm going to let you roll out. And once again, thanks for the shows, Dion.
All right, thanks for the call, Ray. Have a good night.
You too, man. Well, I'm not Ray, but great show.
Wait, who is this?
Well, you know, I go by a couple of names, none of which are real. I like Heathen Core myself, but I'm sure there are listeners out there who know me as somebody else. So, anyway, great show, man. Keep it rolling.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, you too, man.
Yeah. All right, that was a pretty good call. Actually, when I was talking to that person there, I could have sworn that was Ray. Maybe it was Frank. Anyways, I see NorthPal. NorthPal must be listening because he sent me an email. My phone was flashing over here about the Prussian system. I didn't get a chance to, you know, read what he sent to me. Sent me a link for something or something like that. I'll check it out after the show. But thanks, NorthPal, sending me good emails. Hope you're doing all right out there. All right, I'll get back to this. I got this section's almost done here. All right, in 1998, Representative Bob Schaefer placed in the Congressional Record an 18-page letter that has become known as Mr. Mark Tucker's Dear Hillary Letter. Mr. Tucker is president of the National Center on Education and the Economy, and this letter, he laid out a plan to remold the entire American system into a seamless web that literally extends from cradle to grave, is the same for everyone, and the same system for education, or same system for everyone, coordinated by a system of labor market boards at the local, state, and federal levels, where curriculum and job matching must be handled by counselors assessing the integrated computer based program. Mr. Tucker's ambitious plan was implemented in three laws passed by Congress and signed by President Clinton in 1994. Goals 2000 Act, the School to Work Act, and the Reauthorized Elementary and Secondary Education Act. These laws established the following mechanisms to restructure the public schools. Bypass all elected officials on school boards and in-state legislators by making federal funds flow to the governor and his appointees on workforce development boards. Use a computer database, a.k.a. a labor market information system, into which school personnel would scan all information about every school child and its family, identified by the child's social security number, academic, medical, mental, psychological, behavioral, and integrations by counselors. The computerized data would be available to the school, the government, and future employers. So basically everything about your fucking life would be in this database. Use national standards and national testing to cement national control of tests, assessments, school honors and rewards, financial aid, and the Certificate of Initial Mastery, which is designed to replace the high school diploma. The Tucker plans objectives are to train children in specific jobs to serve the workforce and the global economy instead of to educate them so they can make their own life choices. Which is actually, that is pretty funny, since I remember when I was a kid, everybody told you that was what communism was. You know, communism, you didn't have your own life plan. They specified it for you. They told you what job you were going to have, and that's what job you were trained or educated to do. That's what they used to tell us when we were kids, what communism was. Actually, we just went into the archives here. And actually, I'm only halfway through my notes. Well, actually, what I'm going to do, I'm going to skip this part. Kind of went over that. Actually, you can kind of... let me do this quick. Yeah, I'll actually call it this part. So, I got this other thing here. It's not as long. Like I said, that one part about the history and everything like that was pretty long. That was the longest section I had. So, I got this part called Anti-Intellectualism and the Dumbing Down of America. Everything's got the title Dumbing Down of America in it, I guess. So this is by Ray Williams from 2014 in Wired for Success. There's a growing and disturbing trend of anti-intellectual elitism in American culture. It's the dismissal of science, the arts, and humanities, and the replacements by entertainment, self-righteousness, ignorance, and deliberate gullibility. Susan Jacoby, author of The Age of American Unreason, said in an article in the Washington Post, quote, dumbness, to paraphrase the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, has been steadily defined downward for several decades by a combination of heretofore irresistible forces that include the trumpet of video culture over print culture, a disjunction between Americans' rising level of formal education and their shaky grasp of basic geography, science, and history, and the fusion of anti-rationalism with anti-intellectualism, unquote. There has been a long tradition of anti-intellectualism in America, unlike most other Western cultures. Richard Fostatter, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1964 for his book Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, describes how the vast underlying foundation of anti-elite, anti-reason, and anti-science have been infused into America's political and social fabric. Famous science fiction writer Isaac Asimov once said, "There is a cult of ignorance in the United States, and there's always been. The strain of anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through the political and cultural life, nurtured by a false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge." Mark Buehrlein, in his book The Dumbest Generation, reveals how a whole generation of youth is being dumbed down by their aversion to reading anything of substance and their addiction to digital crap via social media. Journalist Charles Pierce, author of Idiot America, adds another perspective. Quote, The rise of Idiot America today represents for-profit mainly, but also more cynically, for political advantage in the pursuit of power. The breakdown of a consensus that the pursuit of knowledge is good. It also represents the absidency of the notion that the people whom we would trust the least are the people who best know what they're talking about. In the new media age, everybody is an expert. There's a persuasive suspicion of rights, privileges, knowledge, and specialization, says Catherine Liu, the author of Academic Anti-Elitism as Cultural Critique, and a film and media studies professor at University of California. The very mission of universities has changed, argues Liu. We don't educate people anymore. We train them to get jobs. Part of the reason for this rising anti-intellectualism can be found in the declining state of education in the U.S. compared to other advanced countries. After leading the world for decades, in 19 to 34 year olds with university degrees in the U.S. is now in 12th place. The World Economic Forum ranked the U.S. at 52nd among the 139 nations in the quality of its university math and science instruction in 2010. Nearly 50% of all graduate students in the sciences in the U.S. are foreigners, most of whom return to their home countries. So yes, you got a lot of people from China and India coming to the U.S. and then going back, so they can ship the jobs back over there and pay them less money than they would pay somebody here. Or they just ship them back over here and pay them less money anyways, like they do with all the dot-headed doctors. The Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs Commission, a civic education poll among public school students, a surprising 77% didn't know that George Washington was the first president. Couldn't name Thomas Jefferson as the author of the Declaration of Independence, and only 2.8% of the students actually passed the citizenship test. Among similar lines, the Goldwater Institute of Phoenix did the same survey, and only 3.5% passed the civics test. According to the National Research Council, only 28% of high school science teachers consistently follow the National Research Council's guidelines on teaching evolution, and 13% of those teachers explicitly advocate creationism or intelligent design. 18% of Americans still believe the sun revolves around the earth. Who the fuck believes? The American Association of State Colleges and Universities report on education shows that the U.S. ranks second among all nations in the proportion of the population aged between 35 and 64 with college degrees, but 19th in the percentage of those aged 25 to 34 with an associate or high school diploma, which means that for the first time, the educational attainment for young people will be lower than their parents. According to the 2009 National Assessment of Education Progress, 68% of public school children in the U.S. do not read proficiently by the time they finish third grade. And the U.S. News and World Report reported that barely 50% of students are ready for college level reading when they graduate. Apparently, I didn't graduate either. according to the 2006 survey by National Geographic, nearly half of Americans between 18 and 24 do not think it is necessary to know the location of other countries in which important news is being made. More than a third consider it not important at all to know any foreign language, and only 14% consider it very important. According to the National Endowment of the Arts, reported in 1982, 82% of the college graduates read novels or poems for pleasure. 2 decades later, only 67% did, and more than 40% of Americans under 44 did not read a single book, fiction or nonfiction, over the course of a year. So 40% of Americans under the age of 44 don't fucking read at all, unless it's on Twitter or Facebook. The proportion of 17-year-olds who read nothing has doubled between 1984 and 2004. Gallup released a poll indicating 42% of Americans still believe God created human beings in their present form less than 10,000 years ago. 42% believe God created people. What the fuck is wrong with you people? A 2008 University of Texas study found that 25% of public school biology teachers believe that humans and dinosaurs inhabited the earth simultaneously. Public schools biology teachers, school teachers, believe that fucking dinosaurs and humans were around at the same time. In American schools, the culture exalts the athlete and the good-looking cheerleader, while educated and intellectual students are commonly referred to in the public schools as the media, as nerds, dweebs, dorks, and geeks, and are relentlessly harassed and even assaulted by more popular jocks for openly displaying any intellect. These anti-intellectual attitudes are not reflected in students in most European or Asian countries, whose intellectual educational levels have now equaled and will surpass that of the U.S. And most TV shows or movies, such as Big Bang Theory, depicts intellectuals as being geek, if not effeminate. John W. Traffagan, professor of religious studies at the University of Texas, argues the problem is that Asian countries have core cultural values that are more akin to a cult of intelligence and education than a cult of ignorance and anti-intellectualism. In Japan, for example, teachers are held in high esteem and normally viewed as among the most important members of a community. It used to be that way in the United States, like 100 fucking years ago. There's suspicion and even disdain for the work of teachers that occurs in the United States. Teachers in Japan are typically paid significantly more than their peers in the U.S. The profession of teachers is one that is seen as being a central value in Japanese society, and those who choose that profession are well compensated in terms of salary, pension, and respect for their knowledge and their efforts on behalf of children. When you got biology teachers, you don't even know when the fuck dinosaurs went extinct. We're creating the world of dummies, angry dummies who feel they have the right, the authority, and the need not only to comment on everything, but to make sure their voice is heard above the rest, and to drag down any opposing views through personal attacks, loud repetition, and confrontation. Bill Keller, writing in the New York Times, argues that the anti-intellectual elitism is not an elitism of wisdom, education, experience, or knowledge. The new elite are the angry social media posters, those who can shout the loudest and more often, a clique of dummies and malcontents banging together like dogs, cornering a fox. Too often it's a combined elite of the anti-intellectuals and the conspiracy followers, not those who can voice the most coherent response. Together they ferment a rabid culture of anti-rationalism where every fact is a suspect, every shadow holds a secret conspiracy. Rational thought is the enemy, critical thinking is the devil's tool. Which actually I've seen crap like that on like Facebook, like you say something, it's like, what's your source on that? I don't fucking know what my source is. I read like 100 goddamn books. Actually, more than 100. I don't know how many books I read in my whole life. I read a lot of goddamn books. I read a lot of stuff all the time. What's my source? I don't remember where I got my source from. I didn't pick it out of Jewipedia, you moron. Alright, Keller also notes that the herd mentality takes over on mine. The anti-intellectuals become more become the metaphorical equivalent of an angry lynch mob when somebody either challenges one of the mob's beliefs or posts something outside of the mob's self-limited set of values. Keller blames this in part to the online universe that skews young, educated, and attentive to fashions. I'm not even sure what that means. I don't know. Fashion, entertainment, spectacle, voyeurism were directed towards trivia, towards the inconsequential, towards unquestioning and blatant consumerism. The result in intellectual complacency. This results in intellectual complacency. People accept without questioning, believe without weighing the choices, join the pack because in a culture where convenience rules, real individualism is too hard of work. Thinking takes too much time. It gets in the way of the immediacy of the online experience. Sorry about that. Hit my mic. reality TV and pop culture presented in magazines and online sites claim to provide useful information about the importance of the housewives of whatever city it is. That can somehow enrich our lives. After all, how else can one explain the insipid and pointless stories that tout divorces, cheating, and weight gain? How else can we explain how the Kardashians or the Paris Hiltons are known for being famous, just for being famous without actually contributing anything worth discussion. The official events of their lives become the mainstay of populist media to distract people from the real issues and concerns facing us. The current trend of increasing anti-intellectualism now establishing itself in politics and business leadership and supported by a declining education system should be a cause of concern for leaders and the general population. But nobody seems to be addressing that at all. It's fine. It'll be okay. All right. So I got one last thing. It's even shorter than that thing. But it should be done in like 10 minutes. Let's see. So this is... Oh, there's one thing I wanted to mention about that last thing here. So, like, anytime anybody brings up crap like that, like the Real Housewives crap or the Kardashians, and I just get this overwhelming sense I wanted to punch somebody in the face. I don't know what it is, but every time somebody brings up something like that in my vicinity, I get so mad about it. I don't know why. I'm just like, well, you shut the fuck up. Maybe that's what... Nothing offends me, right? That's kind of how I am. Nothing really offends me. Maybe that's what being offended is. Maybe just offending that somebody's going to take the time out of their day to talk about this mindless nonsense. Maybe that's what being offended is. I'm not sure. I really don't get offended much. Mud sharks offend me. They offend me. That's pretty much the only thing in my normal day-to-day thing that offends me. Seeing mud sharks. Anyways. Alright, so this last thing I got here is called The Left's Oppressive Moral Monopoly. This is by Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell. That's the other thing, too. With Common Core, they don't teach syllables anymore. They teach whole words. Kids nowadays don't know how to sound out a word. How the hell do you read? You don't know how to sound out a fucking word. You have to be able to sound out a word if you've never seen the word before. How's he going to know how to spell it or say it? How's he going to know how to say it or spell it? You got to know how to do syllables and sound out a word in order to spell a word. So teaching this whole word crap, maybe it's easier to read if you just see the word and you know what, I mean, like most words, you just see them and you know what it is. But like Thomas, is it Sowell or is it Sowell? Well, if you don't know what the word is, Thomas's last name would not be able to be pronounced. Not be able to read or be read. You won't be able to read a damn word. Anyways, crazy math they got too, where you got to do 18 steps to do something that would take you two before. Alright, so this is The Left's Oppressive Moral Monopoly. While it is not possible to answer... Oh, actually, I should cut that part off. He was talking about his... He can't answer all the emails or some crap. I don't even know why I copied that. Anyways, an email from one young man simply asked for the sources of some facts about gun control that were mentioned in a recent column. It is good to check out the facts, especially if you check out facts on both sides of an issue. By contrast, Another man simply denounced me because of what I said in that column. He did not ask for my sources, but simply made contrary assertions, as if his assertions must be correct and therefore mine must be wrong. He identified himself as a physician, and the claims that he made about guns were claims that he had been made years ago in a medical journal and thoroughly discredited since then. He might have learned that if we had engaged in a back and forth discussion, but it was clear from his letter that his goal was not debate, but denunciation. And that is often the case these days. It is always amazing how many serious issues are not discussed seriously, but instead simply generate assertions and counter-assertions. On television, talk shows, people on opposite sides often just try to shout down each other. There is a remarkable range of ways of seeming to argue without actually producing any coherent argument. Decades of dumbed-down education no doubt have something to do with this, but there is more to it than that. Education is not merely neglected in many of our schools today, but is replaced to a great extent by ideological indoctrination. Moreover, it is largely indoctrination based on the same set of underlying and unexamined assumptions among teachers and institutions. See, I don't agree with that last sentence. I don't think it's a set of underlying and unexamined assumptions among teachers and institutions. I think it's actually more deliberate. But anyways, if our educational institutions, from the schools to the universities, or interested in a diversity of ideas, as they are obsessed with racial diversity, students would at least gain experience in seeing the assumptions behind different visions and the role of logic and evidence in debating those differences. Instead, a student can go all the way from elementary school to a PhD without encountering any fundamentally different vision of the world from that of the prevailing political correctness. Moreover, the political perspective that goes with this prevailing ideological view is all too often that of people who see themselves as being on the side of the angels against the forces of evil, social justice warriors. Whether the political issue is at hand, the political issue at hand is gun control, environmentalism, race, or whatever. A moral monopoly is the antithesis of a marketplace of ideas. One sign of this sense of moral monopoly among the left intelligentsia is that the institutions most under their control, the school, colleges, and universities, have far less freedom of speech than the rest of American society. While advocacy of homosexuality, for example, is common on college campuses, and listening to its advocacy is often obligatory during freshman orientation, criticism of homosexuality is called hate speech, and that is subject to punishment. While spokesmen for various racial and ethnic groups are free to vehemently denounce whites as a group for their past or present sins, real or otherwise, any white student who similarly denounces the sins or shortcomings of non-white groups can be virtually guaranteed to be punished, if not expelled. Even students who do not advocate anything can have to pay a price if they do not go along with the classroom brainwashing. The student at Florida Atlantic University, who recently declined to stomp on a paper with the word Jesus on it, was ordered by the professor, was scheduled for punishment by the university until the story became public and provoked an outcry from outside academia. This professor's action might not have might be dismissed as an isolated extreme, but the university's establishment initial solid backing for him and is coming down hard on the student shows that the moral dry rot goes far deeper than one brainwashed professor. The failure of our educational system goes beyond what they fail to teach and includes what they do teach, or rather indoctrinate, and the graduates they send out into the world, incapable of seriously weighing alternatives for themselves or for American society. So that's the end of that section, article, whatever you want to call it, which actually is entirely true, which I think most of us know. They have no actual arguments for anything, you know. They mostly, you know, towards us, they just, you know, cry racist, anti-Semite, bigot, etc., etc. And that's actually both sides of the political aisle. We've been brainwashed to think that way. You know, the lefts are far worse than your conservatives. Still a bunch of brainwashed Zionist fools. Alright, so I lied. I got one more other thing that actually has nothing to do with the topic for tonight, but it was a kind of amusing little list I found this morning. Actually, this is from erasingus.com. It's actually from yesterday. I found it this morning. It was posted yesterday. This is actually called Know Your Enemy, the Five Types of Liberal White Men. Thought this was kind of funny, kind of amusing, kind of a more upbeat and lighthearted way to go out tonight. All right. So there are a few types of liberal white males that exist today, and we're going to cover five of them. They're creepy, they are emotional, they are illogical, and they all play an important role in erasing us. The most integral part of the struggle for white survival is for you to understand who your enemy is and then study them. Know them like the backside of your hand. Understand the way they think to make yourself more formidable, a more formidable debater. Understand how to exploit the loopholes, double standards, and fallacies in their emotional pleas to erase their white race from planet Earth. Now, here we are. The five types of white liberal men. Number one, the blue pill beta male. These are the kinds of men who you find identifying themselves as feminists because they think it will get them laid. Little do they know, women really aspire to be with an alpha male. Perhaps this is why the majority of feminists have rape fantasies to the point where they invent terms like rape culture. Nevertheless, these men typically surround themselves with social justice warrior white females with multicolored hair, nose piercings, and oversized eyeglasses, and kowtow to their social outrage causes. Number two. The white husband who gets off on watching his wife bang black guys. These types of white liberals are particularly gross. The problem they have is more or less rooted in a serious psychological disease that stems from an addiction to hardcore pornography. And they need to find something more and more taboo. And the only thing they can eventually achieve satisfaction on is by abusing themselves by handling their wives and sometimes daughters off to black men. They also have an inherent inferiority complex. They buy into the Jewish poison that white men are inferior sexual providers to their women, as propagated in the Jewish media commercials, television shows, movies, and music. A part of this, particularly among the younger generation of white communists, is some sort of penance for the sins of their racist ancestors. Seriously, there's a whole corner of the internet dedicated to this filth. They aren't open about their hatred for white people, but you can bet they were amongst the first to line up to vote for Barack Obama twice. There you got the cucks. All right. Number three is the academic white communist. Under any other circumstances, like not having wealthy parents, they would have become a gutter rat anti-fa activist. But their parents, who have worked hard for their entire lives to accumulate a savings account and send their kids to university, end up with a child who gets indoctrinated into gender studies and white privilege sociology classes. They buy the malarkey of their Jewish communist professor, who are burnouts from the 1960s hippie movement. Bring it all down, man. They use words and phrases like structural racism and white privilege and express particular concern about rape culture. He may even go so far as to post pictures on his Tumblr and Twitter accounts of himself holding up a Sharpie marked sign saying this is what a feminist looks like, or notes about his white skin privilege. What these people do is regurgitate the kind of far-left nonsense that their professors teach them. They live so well, their life is so great, they have so many opportunities that they need to find something wrong with the world and adhere to neo-Marxist nonsense. There's number four of the liberal white male, the union worker. I'm having a hard time with this one simply because it's tough to consider drywall hangers, carpenters, painters, plumbers, and other craftsmen as liberal by 2015 standards. Your average unionized contractor more than likely does not want his daughter marrying Tyrone and certainly does not buy into the white privilege bullshit. But for all intent and purposes, he is as dangerous to the future of the white race as numbers 1 through 3 on our list, and I'll tell you why. The union worker primarily votes Democrat and by default liberal for purely economic reasons. Whether you realize it or not, the union thug who votes blue to save his pension and platinum health benefits and 6 weeks of vacation is almost as harmful to white society as the ghetto waste in a Section 8 housing development who is eating McDonald's, smoking Newports, and drinking Miller High Life on your dime. Would you believe that these two people are voting alongside these people? I think that's not worded right. Anyways. Would you believe that these damn people are voting the same way? The sheer greed of many white males to vote such a way to preserve their own arbitrary wealth has been and continues to be devastating and will ultimately be what gets Hillary Clinton elected in 2016. A sure voting Republican would set his sons to fight Israel But holy cow. Oh, sons to fight for Israel. We can only hope they go to fight Israel. Anyways. You can thank this type of liberal for Barack Obama. And then number five, the last one on the list here of the five types of white liberal men. Number five is the one who is starting to get it. There comes a time when every man has to take a long, hard look in the mirror and answer to himself. There's undoubtedly a contingent, a well-intentioned white liberal male who realizes that no matter how much social justice warrying around they do, they will still be considered the ultimate scum of society. All the men on this list, perhaps with the exception of number two, number two was, oh, the cucks. Where was I? Okay. All the men on this list, perhaps the exception of number two, who are the cucks, who is who he is because of childhood abuse and perverted pornography addiction, will in due time realize that they just aren't welcome and certainly aren't needed anymore. The feminists truly hate men, so they no longer need the pity points, since enough of the idiots in America believe in farces like rape culture and general inequality. The campus chapter of the Black Panthers and Muslim Brotherhood will capitalize on the emotionality of white women and no longer need white men to kiss their ass. This mass expanding non-white population in America will be enough to get Democrats elected, and the pensions of union workers will be unfunded liabilities and the first thing to go when the shit hits the fan. Actually, I would agree with that last statement there. That it's got no white men to pay for all these pensions and other tax subsidies to fund the non-whites. You know, once we're gone, who's going to pay for that crap? Might have to go on and get a real job. Anyways. So, yeah, we got about 15 minutes left before they cut me off, so I think I'll close the show out here. Wow. And thanks to all the listeners tonight. Thanks to the caller. Hope everybody had a good night. Let's play us out with a song. Actually, I don't know if I played this song already or not. Not tonight, but some other time. So actually, I'm going to play City Saints, Kicking Ass for the Working Class. Thank you. Have a good night. Lost!